opened. Its lock may have rusted or broken away from the clasp. Still, you should touch the nail heads and test its weight. No smashing with an axe head before it is decently exhumed from the grave that has hidden it all this time. No gasp, but a miracle that is truly miraculous because the magic lies in the fact that you knew it was there for you all along. Setha wiped the white satin coat from the inside of the pan, brought pillows from the keeping room for the girls' heads. There was no tremor in her voice as she instructed them to keep the fire. If not, come on upstairs. With that, she gathered her blanket around her elbows and ascended the lily-white stairs like a bride. Outside, snow solidified itself into graceful forms. The peace of winter stars seemed permanent. Fingering a ribbon and smelling skin, Stamp Paid approached 124 again. My marrow is tired, he thought. I've been tired all my days, bone tired. But now, it's in the marrow. Must be what Baby Suggs felt when she lay down and thought about color for the rest of her life. When she told him what her aim was, he thought she was ashamed, and too ashamed to say so. Her authority in the pulpit, her dance in the clearing, her powerful call. She didn't deliver sermons or preach, insisting she was too ignorant for that. She called, and the hearing heard. All that had been mocked and rebuked by the blood spill in her backyard. God puzzled her, and she was too ashamed of him to say so. Instead, she told Stamp she was going to bed to think about the colors of things. He tried to dissuade her. Setha was in jail with her nursing baby, the one he had saved. Her sons were holding hands in the yard, terrified of letting go. Strangers and familiars were stopping by to hear how it went one more time. And suddenly, Baby declared peace. She just up and quit. By the time Setha was released, she had exhausted blue and was well on her way to yellow. At first he would see her in the yard occasionally, or delivering food to the jail or shoes in town. Then less and less. He believed then that shame put her in the bed. Now, 8 years after her contentious funeral and 18 years after the misery, he changed his mind. Her marrow was tired, and it was a testimony to the heart that fed it that it took 8 years to meet finally the color she was hankering after. The onslaught of her fatigue, like his, was sudden, but lasted for years. After 60 years of losing children to the people who chewed up her life and spit it out like a fishbone. After 5 years of freedom given to her by her last child, who bought her future with his, exchanged it, so to speak, so she could have one whether he did or not, to lose him too, to acquire a daughter and grandchildren, to see that daughter slay the children, or try to belong to a community of other free Negroes, to love and be loved by them, to counsel and be counseled, protect and be protected, feed and be fed, and then to have that community step back, hold itself at a distance. Well, it could wear out even a Baby Suggs wholly. Listen here, girl, he told her. You can't quit the word. It's given to you to speak. You can't quit the word. I don't care what all happened to you. They were standing in Richmond Street, ankle-deep in leaves. Lamps lit the downstairs windows of spacious houses and made the early evening look darker than it was. The odor of burning leaves was brilliant. Quite by chance, as he pocketed a penny tip for a delivery, he had glanced across the street and recognized the skipping woman as his old friend. He had not seen her in weeks. Quickly, he crossed the street, scuffing red leaves as he went. When he stopped her with a greeting, she returned it with a face knocked clean of interest. She could have been a plate. A carpet bag full of shoes in her hand, she waited for him to begin, lead, or share a conversation. If there had been sadness in her eyes, he would have understood it, but indifference lodged where sadness should have been. "You missed the clearing 3 Saturdays running," he told her. She turned her head away and scanned the houses along the street. "Folks came," he said. "Folks come, folks go," she answered. "Here, let me carry that." He tried to take her bag from her, but she wouldn't let him. "I got a delivery someplace long in here," she said. "Name of Tucker." "Yonder," he said. "Twin chestnuts in the yard. Sick, too." They walked a bit. His pace slowed to accommodate her skip. "Well?" "Well, what?" "Saturday coming. You gonna call or what?"
"If I call them and they come, what on earth I'm going to say?"
"Say the word." He checked his shout too late. 2 white men burning leaves turned their heads in his direction. Bending low, he whispered into her ear, "The word. The word." "That's one other thing took away from me," she said. And that was when he exhorted her, pleaded with her not to quit, no matter what. The word had been given to her, and she had to speak it, had to. They had reached the twin chestnuts and the white house that stood behind them. "See what I mean?" he said. "Big trees like that, both of them together, ain't got the leaves of a young birch." "I see what you mean," she said, but she peered instead at the white house. "You got to do it," he said. "You got to. Can't nobody call like you. You have to be there." "What I have to do is get in my bed and lay down. I want to fix on something harmless in this world." "What world you talking about? Ain't nothing harmless down here."
"Yes, it is. Blue, that don't hurt nobody. Yellow neither."
"You getting in the bed to think about yellow?"
"I likes yellow."
"Then what? When you get through with blue and yellow, then what?"
"Can't say. If something can't be planned."
"You blaming God," he said. "That's what you doing."
"No, Stamp, I ain't."
"You saying the white folks won? That what you saying?"
"I'm saying they came in my yard."
"You saying nothing counts?"
"I'm saying they came in my yard. Seth is the one did it, and if she hadn't..."
"You saying God give up? Nothing left for us but pour out our own blood?"
"I'm saying they came in my yard."
"You punishing him, ain't you?"
"Not like he punished me."
"You can't do that, baby. It ain't right."
"Was the time I knew what that was."
"You still know."
"What I know is what I see. A nigger woman hauling shoes."
"Oh, baby."
He licked his lips, searching with his tongue for the words that would turn her around, lighten her load. "We have to be steady. These things too will pass. What you looking for? A miracle?"
"No," she said. "I'm looking for what I was put here to look for. The back door." And skipped right to it. They didn't let her in. They took the shoes from her as she stood on the steps, and she rested her hip on the railing, while the white woman went looking for the dime. Stamp paid, rearranged his way. Too angry to walk her home and listen to more, he watched her for a moment and turned to go before the alert white face at the window next door had come to any conclusion. Trying to get to 124 for the second time now, he regretted that conversation, the high tone he took, his refusal to see the effect of marrow weariness in a woman he believed was a mountain. Now, too late, he understood her. The heart that pumped out love, the mouth that spoke the word, didn't count. They came in her yard anyway, and she could not approve or condemn Sepha's rough choice. One or the other might have saved her, but beaten up by the claims of both, she went to bed. The white folks
had tired her out at last. And him. 1874, and white folks were still on the loose. Whole towns wiped clean of Negroes. 87 lynchings in 1 year alone in Kentucky. 4 colored schools burned to the ground. Grown men whipped like children, children whipped like adults, black women raped by the crew, property taken, necks broken. He smelled skin, skin and hot blood. The skin was one thing, but human blood, cooked in a lynch fire, was a whole other thing. The stench stank up off the pages of the North Star, out of the mouths of witnesses, etched in crooked handwriting and letters delivered by hand, detailed in documents and petitions full of whereas, and presented to any legal body who'd read it. It stank. But none of that had worn out his marrow, none of that. It was the ribbon. Tying his flatbed up on the bank of the Licking River, securing it the best he could, he caught sight of something red on its bottom. Reaching for it, he thought it was a cardinal feather stuck to his boat. He tugged, and what came loose in his hand was a red ribbon knotted around a curl of wet, woolly hair, clinging still to its bit of scalp. He untied the ribbon and put it in his pocket, dropped the curl in the weeds. On the way home he stopped, short of breath and dizzy. He waited until the spell passed before continuing on his way. A moment later, his breath left him again. This time he sat down by a fence. Rested, he got to his feet. But before he took a step, he turned to look back down the road he was traveling and said to its frozen mud and the river beyond, "What are these people? You tell me, Jesus, what are they?" When he got to his house, he was too tired to eat the food his sister and nephews had prepared. He sat on the porch in the cold till way past dark and went to his bed only because his sister's voice calling him was getting nervous. He kept the ribbon, the skin smell nagged him, and his weakened marrow made him dwell on baby Suggs's wish to consider what in the world was harmless. He hoped she stuck to blue, yellow, maybe green, and never fixed on red. Mistaking her, upbraiding her, owing her, now he needed to let her know he knew, and to get right with her and her kin. So in spite of his exhausted marrow, he kept on through the voices and tried once more to knock at the door of 124. This time, although he couldn't cipher but one word, he believed he knew who spoke them. The people of the broken necks, of fire-cooked blood, and black girls who had lost their ribbons. What a roaring! Setha had gone to bed smiling, eager to lie down and unravel the proof for the conclusion she had already leapt to, fondle the day and circumstances of beloved's arrival and the meaning of that kiss in the clearing. She slept instead and woke, still smiling, to a snow-bright morning, cold enough to see her breath. She lingered a moment to collect the courage to throw off the blankets and hit a chilly floor. For the first time, she was going to be late for work. Downstairs, she saw the girls sleeping where she'd left them, but back to back now, each wrapped tight in blankets, breathing into their pillows. The pair and a half of skates were lying by the front door. The stockings hung on a nail behind the cooking stove to dry, had not. Setha looked at beloved's face and smiled. Quietly, carefully, she stepped around her to wake the fire. First a bit of paper, then a little Kenlan, not too much, just a taste until it was strong enough for more. She fed its dance until it was wild and fast. When she went outside to collect more wood from the shed, she did not notice the man's frozen footprints. She crunched around to the back, to the cord piled high with snow. After scraping it clean, she filled her arms with as much dry wood as she could. She even looked straight at the shed, smiling at the things she would not have to remember now, thinking, "She ain't even mad with me, not a bit." Obviously, the hand-holding shadows she had seen on the road were not Paul D. Denver and herself, but us three, the three holding on to each other, skating the night before, the three sipping flavored milk. And since that was so, if her daughter could come back home from the timeless place, certainly her sons could and would come back from wherever they had gone to. Setha covered her front teeth with her tongue against the cold. Hunched forward by the burden in her arms, she walked back around the house to the porch, not once noticing the frozen tracks she stepped in. Inside, the girls were still sleeping, although they had changed positions while she was gone, both drawn to the fire. Dumping the armload into the wood box made them stir, but not wake. Setha started the cooking stove as quietly as she could, reluctant to wake the sisters, happy to have them asleep at her feet while she made breakfast. Too bad she would be late for work. Too bad. Once in 16 years, that's just too bad. She had beaten 2 eggs into yesterday's hominy, formed it into patties, and fried them with some ham pieces before Denver woke completely and groaned. Back stiff? Ooh, yeah. Sleeping on the floor is supposed to be good for you. Hurts like the devil, said Denver. Could be that fall you took. Denver smiled. That was fun. She turned to look down at Beloved snoring lightly. Should I wake her? No, let her rest. She likes to see you off in the morning. I'll make sure she does, said Setha, and thought, be nice to think first before I talk to her. Let her know I know. Think about all I ain't got to remember no more. Do like baby said. Think on it, then lay it down for good. Paul D. convinced me there was a world out there and that I could live in it. Should have known better, did know better. Whatever's going on outside my door ain't for me. The world is in this room. This here's all there is and all there needs to be. They ate like men, ravenous and intent, saying little, content with the company of the other and the opportunity to look in her eyes. When Setha wrapped her head and bundled up to go to town, it was already mid-morning, and when she left the house, she neither saw the prints nor heard the voices that ringed 124 like a noose. Trudging in the ruts left earlier by wheels, Setha was excited to giddiness by the thing she no longer had to remember. I don't have to remember nothing. I don't even have to explain. She understands it all. I can forget how Baby Suggs's heart collapsed, how we agreed it was consumption without a sign of it in the world. Her eyes, when she brought my food, I can forget that. How she told me that Howard and Bugler were all right, but wouldn't let go each other's hands. Played that way, stayed that way, especially in their sleep. She handed me the food from a basket, things wrapped small enough to get through the bars, whispering news, Mr. Bodwin going to see the judge In chambers, she kept on saying, in chambers, like I knew what it meant, or she did. The colored ladies of Delaware, Ohio, had drawn up a petition to keep me from being hanged. That two white preachers had come around and wanted to talk to me, pray for me. That a newspaper man came, too. She told me the news, and I told her I needed something for the rats. She wanted Denver out and slapped her palms when I wouldn't let her go. "Wear your earrings," she said. "I'll hold them for you." I told her the jailer took them to protect me from myself. He thought I could do some harm with the wire. Baby Suggs covered her mouth with her hand. "School teacher left town," she said. "Filed a claim and rode on off." "They're gonna let you out for the burial," she said. "Not the funeral, just the burial." And they did. The sheriff came with me and looked away when I fed Denver in the wagon. Neither Howard nor Bugler would let me near them, not even to touch their hair. I believe a lot of folks were there, but I just saw the box. Reverend Pike spoke in a real loud voice, but I didn't catch a word, except the first two. And 3 months later, when Denver was ready for solid food, and they let me out for good, I went and got you a gravestone. But I didn't have enough money for the carving, so I exchanged, bartered, you might say, what I did have. And I'm sorry to this day I never thought to ask him for the whole thing. All I heard of what Reverend Pike said, "Dearly beloved," which is what you are to me, and I don't have to be sorry about getting only one word, and I don't have to remember the slaughterhouse and the Saturday girls who worked its yard. I can forget that what I did changed Baby Suggs's life. No clearing, no company, just laundry and shoes. I can forget it all now because as soon as I got the gravestone in place, you made your presence known in the house and worried us all to distraction. I didn't understand it then. I thought you were mad with me. And now I know that if you was, you ain't now because you came back here to me. And I was right all along. There is no world outside my door. I only need to know one thing. How bad is the scar? As Setha walked to work, late for the first time in 16 years, and wrapped in a timeless present, stamp paid fought fatigue and the habit of a lifetime, Baby Suggs refused to go to the clearing because she believed they had won. He refused to acknowledge any such victory. Baby had no back door, so he braved the cold and a wall of talk to knock on the one she did have. He clutched the red ribbon in his pocket for strength, softly at first, then harder. At the last, he banged furiously, disbelieving it could happen, that the door of a house with colored people in it did not fly open in his presence. He went to the window and wanted to cry. Sure enough, there they were, not a one of them heading for the door. Worrying his scrap of ribbon to shreds, the old man turned and went down the steps. Now curiosity joined his shame and his debt. Two backs curled away from him as he looked in the window. One had a head he recognized. The other troubled him. He didn't know her and didn't know anybody it could be. Nobody. But nobody visited that house. After a disagreeable breakfast, he went to see Ella and John to find out what they knew. Perhaps there he could find out if, after all these years of clarity, he had misnamed himself, and there was yet another debt he owed. Born Joshua, he renamed himself when he handed over his wife to his master's son. Handed her over in the sense that He did not kill anybody, there by himself, because his wife demanded he stay alive. Otherwise, she reasoned, where and to whom could she return when the boy was through? With that gift, he decided that he didn't owe anybody anything. Whatever his obligations were, that act paid them off. He thought it would make him rambunctious, renegade, a drunkard even, the debtlessness. And in a way it did. But there was nothing to do with it. Work well, work poorly, work a little, work not at all, make sense, make none, sleep, wake up, like somebody, dislike others. It didn't seem much of a way to live, and it brought him no satisfaction. So he extended this debtlessness to other people by helping them pay out and off whatever they owed in misery. Beaten runaways, he ferried them and rendered them paid for, gave them their own bill of sale, so to speak. You paid it, now life owes you. And the receipt, as it were, was a welcome door that he never had to knock on, like John and Ella's, in front of which he stood and said, "Who in there?" Only once, and she was pulling on the hinge. "Where you been keeping yourself? I told John, must be cold if stamps stay inside." "Oh, I've been out." He took off his cap and massaged his scalp. "Out where? Not by here." Ella hung two suits of underwear on a line behind the stove. "Was over to Baby Suggs's this morning." "What you want in there?" asked Ella. "Somebody invite you in?" "That's Baby's can. I don't need no invite to look after her people." Ella was unmoved. She had been Baby Suggs's friend and Setha's too till the rough time. Except for a nod at the carnival, she hadn't given Setha the time of day. "Somebody new in there, a woman. Thought you might know who is she." "Ain't no new Negroes in this town I don't know about," she said. "What she look like? You sure that wasn't Denver?" "I know Denver. This girl's narrow." "You sure?" "I know what I see." "Might see anything at all at 124. "True." "Better ask Paul D," she said. "Can't locate him," said Stamp, which was the truth, although his efforts to find Paul D had been feeble. He wasn't ready to confront the man whose life he had altered with his graveyard information. "He's sleeping in the church," said Ella. "The church?" Stamp was shocked and very hurt. "Yeah, ask Reverend Pike if he could stay in the cellar. It's cold as charity in there." "I expect he knows that." "What'd he do that for?" "He's a touch proud, seemed like." "He don't have to do that. Any number'll take him in." Ella turned round to look at Stamp Paid. "Can't nobody read minds long distance? All you have to do is ask somebody." "Why? Why you have to ask? Can't nobody offer? What's going on? Since when a black man come to town have to sleep in a cellar like a dog?" "Unrile yourself, Stamp." "Not me. I'm gonna stay riled till somebody gets some sense, and leastway act like a Christian." "It's only a few days he been there." "Shouldn't be no days. You know all about it and don't give him a hand." "That don't sound like you, Ella. Me and you been pulling colored folk out the water more'n 20 years. Now you tell me you can't offer a man a bed, a working man too, a man what can pay his own way?" "He ask, I give him anything." "Why is that necessary all of a sudden?" "I don't know him all that well. You know he's colored." "Stamp, don't tear me up this morning. I don't feel like it." "It's her, ain't it?" "Her who? Setha? He took up with her and stayed in there, and you don't want nothing to..." "Hold on. Don't jump if you can't see bottom. Girl, give it up. We've been friends too long to act like this." "Well, who can tell what all went on in there? Look here. I don't know who Setha is or none of her people." "What?" All I know is she married Baby Suggs's boy, and I ain't sure I know that. Where is he, huh? Baby never laid eyes on her till John carried her to the door with a baby I strapped on her chest. I strapped that baby, and you way off the track with that wagon. Her children know who she was, even if you don't. So what? I ain't saying she wasn't their mammy, but who's to say they were Baby Suggs's grandchildren? How she get on board and her husband didn't? And tell me this, how she have that baby in the woods by herself? Said a white woman come out the trees and helped her. Shoot, you believe that? A white woman? Well, I know what kind of white that was. Oh, no, Ella. Anything white floating around in the woods? If it ain't got a shotgun, it's something I don't want no part of. You all was friends. Yeah, till she showed herself. Ella, I ain't got no friends take a handsaw to their own children. You in deep water, girl, uh-uh. I'm on dry land and I'm gonna stay there. You the one wet. What's any of what you talking got to do with Paul D? What run him off, tell me that. I run him off. You? I told him about, I showed him the newspaper, about the, what Setha did, read it to him. He left that very day. He didn't tell me that. I thought he knew. He didn't know nothing, except her, from when they was at that place Baby Suggs was at. He knew Baby Suggs? Sure he knew her. Her boy Hallie, too. And left when he found out what Setha did? Looked like he might have a place to stay after all. What you say casts a different light, I thought. But Stampede knew what she thought. You didn't come here asking about him, Ella said. You came about some new girl. That's so. Well, Paul D must know who she is, or what she is. Your mind is loaded with spirits. Everywhere you look, you see one. You know as well as I do that people who die bad don't stay in the ground. He couldn't deny it. Jesus Christ himself didn't. So Stamp ate a piece of Ella's head cheese to show there were no bad feelings and set out to find Paul D. He found him on the steps of Holy Redeemer, holding his wrists between his knees and looking red-eyed. Sawyer shouted at her when she entered the kitchen, but she just turned her back and reached for her apron. There was no entry now, no crack or crevice available. She had taken pains to keep them out, but knew full well that at any moment they could rock her, rip her from her moorings, send the birds twittering back into her hair, drain her mother's milk they'd already done, divided her back into plant life, that too, driven her fat-bellied into the woods. They had done that. All news of them was rot. They buttered Hallie's face, gave Paul D. iron to eat, crisped 6-0, hanged her own mother. She didn't want any more news about white folks, didn't want to know what Ella knew and John and Stamp paid about the world done up the way white folks loved it. All news of them should have stopped with the birds in her hair. Once, long ago, she was soft, trusting. She trusted Mrs. Garner and her husband, too. She knotted the earrings into her underskirt to take along, not so much to wear, but to hold. Earrings that made her believe she could discriminate among them, that for every school teacher there would be an Amy, that for every pupil there was a Garner, or Bodwin, or even a sheriff, whose touch at her elbow was gentle, and who looked away when she nursed. But she had come to believe every one of Baby Suggs's last words and buried all recollection of them and luck. Paul D. dug it up, gave her back her body, kissed her divided back, stirred her rememory, and brought her more news of clabber, of iron, of roosters smiling. But when he heard her news, he counted her feet and didn't even say goodbye. Don't talk to me, Mr. Sawyer. Don't say nothing to me this morning. What?
What? What? You talking back to me?
I'm telling you, don't say nothing to me. You better get them pies made. Setha touched the fruit and picked up the paring knife. When pie juice hit the bottom of the oven and hissed, Setha was well into the potato salad. Sawyer came in and said, not too sweet. You make it too sweet, they don't eat it. Make it the way I always did. Yeah, too sweet. None of the sausages came back. The cook had away with them, and Sawyer's restaurant never had leftover sausage. If Setha wanted any, she put them aside as soon as they were ready. But there was some passable stew. Problem was, all her pies were sold too. Only rice pudding left, and half a pan of gingerbread that didn't come out right. Had she been paying attention instead of daydreaming all morning, she wouldn't be picking around, looking for her dinner like a crab. She couldn't read clock time very well, but she knew when the hands were closed in prayer at the top of the face, she was through for the day. She got a metal top jar, filled it with stew, and wrapped the gingerbread in butcher paper. These she dropped in her outer skirt pockets and began washing up. None of it was anything like what the cook and the two waiters walked off with. Mr. Sawyer included midday dinner in the terms of the job, along with $3.40 a week, and she made him understand from the beginning she would take her dinner home. But matches, sometimes a bit of kerosene, a little salt, butter too, these things she took also once in a while, and felt ashamed because she could afford to buy them. She just didn't want the embarrassment of waiting out back of Phelps's store with the others till every white in Ohio was served before the keeper turned to the cluster of Negro faces looking through a hole in his back door. She was ashamed, too, because it was stealing, and Sixo's argument on the subject amused her but didn't change the way she felt, just as it didn't change schoolteacher's mind. Did you steal that shote? You stole that shote. Schoolteacher was quiet but firm, like he was just going through the motions, not expecting an answer that mattered. Sixo sat there, not even getting up to plead or deny. He just sat there, the streak of lean in his hand, the gristle clustered in the tin plate like gemstones, rough, unpolished, but looped nevertheless. You stole that shote, didn't you? No, sir, said Sixo, but he had the decency to keep his eyes on the meat. You telling me you didn't steal it, and I'm looking right at you? No, sir, I didn't steal it. School teacher smiled. Did you kill it? Yes, sir, I killed it. Did you butcher it? Yes, sir. Did you cook it? Yes, sir. Well, then, did you eat it? Yes, sir, sure did. And you telling me that's not stealing? No, sir, it ain't. What is it, then? Improving your property, sir. What? Sixo plant rye to give the high piece a better chance? Sixo take and feed the soil, give you more crop. Sixo take and feed Sixo, give you more work. Clever. But school teacher beat him anyway. To show him that definitions belong to the definers, not the defined. After Mr. Garner died, with a hole in his ear that Mrs. Garner said was an exploded eardrum brought on by stroke, and Sixo said was gunpowder, everything they touched was looked on as stealing. Not just a rifle of corn, or 2 yard eggs the hen herself didn't even remember. Everything. Schoolteacher took away the guns from the Sweet Home men, and deprived of game to round out their diet of bread, beans, hominy, vegetables, and a little extra at slaughter time. They began to pilfer in earnest, and it became not only their right, but their obligation. Setha understood it then, but now with a paying job and an employer who's kind enough to hire an ex-convict, she despised herself for the pride that made pilfering better than standing in line at the window of the general's store with all the other Negroes. She didn't want to jostle them or be jostled by them, feel their judgment or their pity, especially now. She touched her forehead with the back of her wrist and blotted the perspiration. The workday had come to a close, and already she was feeling the excitement. Not since that other escape had she felt so alive. Slopping the alley dogs, watching their frenzy, she pressed her lips. Today would be a day she would accept a lift if anybody on a wagon offered it. No one would, and for 16 years her pride had not let her ask. But today, oh, today. Now she wanted speed to skip over the long walk home and be there. When Sawyer warned her about being late again, she barely heard him. He used to be a sweet man, patient, tender in his dealings with his help. But each year, following the death of his son in the war, he grew more and more crotchety, as though Setha's dark face was to blame. "Mm-hmm," she said, wondering how she could hurry time along and get to the no time waiting for her. She needn't have worried. Wrapped tight, hunched forward, as she started home, her mind was busy with the things she could forget. Thank God I don't have to remember or say a thing, because you know it all. You know I never would have left you, never. It was all I could think of to do. When the train came, I had to be ready. School teacher was teaching us things we couldn't learn. I didn't care nothing about the measuring string. We all laughed about that, except Sixo. He didn't laugh at nothing, but I didn't care. School teacher'd wrap that string all over my head, across my nose, around my behind, numb of my teeth. I thought he was a fool. And the questions he asked was the biggest foolishness of all. Then me and your brothers come up from the second patch. The first one was close to the house, where the quick things grew, beans, onions, sweet peas. The other one was further down for long-lasting things, potatoes, pumpkin, okra, pork salad. Not much was up yet down there. It was early still. Some young salad, maybe, but that was all. We pulled weeds and hoed a little to give everything a good start. After that, we hid out for the house. The ground raised up from the second patch, not a hill exactly, but kind of. Enough for Bugler and Howard to run up and roll down, run up and roll down. That's the way I used to see them in my dreams, laughing, their short fat legs running up the hill. Now all I see is their backs, walking down the railroad tracks, away from me, always away from me. But that day they was happy, running up and rolling down. It was early still. The growing season had took hold, but not much was up. I remember the peas still had flowers. The grass was long, though, full of white buds. And those tall red blossoms people call Diane, and something there with the leastest little bit of blue. Light, like a cornflower, but pale, pale, real pale. I maybe should have hurried, because I left you back at the house, in a basket in the yard, away from where the chicken scratched, but you never know. Anyway, I took my time getting back, but your brothers didn't have patience with me staring at flowers and sky every 2 or 3 steps. They ran all ahead, and I let them. Something sweet lives in the air that time of year. And if the breeze is right, It's hard to stay indoors. When I got back, I could hear Howard and Bugler laughing down by the quarters. I put my hoe down and cut across the side yard to get to you. The shade moved, so by the time I got back, the sun was shining right on you, right in your face. But you wasn't woke at all, still asleep. I wanted to pick you up in my arms, and I wanted to look at you sleeping, too. Didn't know which. You had the sweetest face. Yonder, not far, was a grape arbor Mr. Garner made. Always full of big plans, he wanted to make his own wine to get drunk off. Never did get more than a kettle of jelly from it. I don't think the soil was right for grapes. Your daddy believed it was the rain, not the soil. Sixo said it was bugs. The grapes so little and tight, sour as vinegar, too. But there was a little table in there, so I picked up your basket and carried you over to the grape arbor, cool in there and shady. I set you down on the little table and figured if I got a piece of muslin, the bugs and things wouldn't get to you. And if Mrs. Garner didn't need me right there in the kitchen, I could get a chair and you and me could sit out there while I did the vegetables. I headed for the back door to get the clean muslin we kept in the kitchen press. The grass felt good on my feet. I got near the door and I heard voices. School teacher made his pupils sit and learn books for a spell every afternoon. If it was nice enough weather, they'd sit on the side porch, all three of them. He'd talk and they'd write. Or he would read and they would write down what he said. I never told nobody this. Not your pap, not nobody. I almost told Mrs. Garner, but she was so weak then and getting weaker. This is the first time I'm telling it, and I'm telling it to you because it might help explain something to you, although I know you don't need me to do it, to tell it or even think over it. You don't have to listen either if you don't want to, but I couldn't help listening to what I heard that day. He was talking to his pupils, and I heard him say, "Which one are you doing?" And one of the boys said, "Setha." That's when I stopped, because I heard my name. And then I took a few steps to where I could see what they was doing. School teacher was standing over one of them, with one hand behind his back. He licked a forefinger a couple of times and turned a few pages. Slow. I was about to turn around and keep on my way to where the muslin was, when I heard him say, "No, no, that's not the way. I told you to put her human characteristics on the left, her animal ones on the right, and don't forget to line them up." I commenced to walk backward. I didn't even look behind me to find out where I was headed. I just kept lifting my feet and pushing back. When I bumped up against a tree, my scalp was prickly. One of the dogs was licking out a pan in the yard. I got to the grape arbor fast enough, but I didn't have the muslin. Flies settled all over your face, rubbing their hands. My head itched like the devil, like somebody was sticking fine needles in my scalp. I never told Hallie or nobody, but that very day, I asked Mrs. Garner a part of it. She was low then, not as low as she ended up, but failing. A kind of bag grew under her jaw. It didn't seem to hurt her, but it made her weak. First, she'd be up and spry in the morning, and by the second milking, she couldn't stand up. Next, she took to sleeping late. The day I went up there, she was in bed the whole day. I thought to carry her some bean soup and ask her then. When I opened the bedroom door, she looked at me from underneath her nightcap. Already it was hard to catch life in her eyes. Her shoes and stockings are on the floor, so I knew she had tried to get dressed. I brung you some bean soup, I said. She said, I don't think I can swallow that. Try a bit, I told her. Too thick. I'm sure it's too thick. Want me to loosen it up with a little water? No, take it away. Bring me some cool water, that's all. Yes, ma'am. Ma'am, could I ask you something? What is it, Zetha? What do characteristics mean? What? A word. Characteristics. Oh. She moved her head around on the pillow. Features. Who taught you that? I heard the school teacher say it. Change the water, Zetha. This is warm. Yes, ma'am. Features? Water, Zetha. Cool water. I put the pitcher on the tray with the white bean soup and went downstairs. When I got back with the fresh water, I held her head while she drank. It took her a while because that lump made it hard to swallow. She laid back and wiped her mouth. The drinking seemed to satisfy her, but she frowned and said, I don't seem able to wake up, Zetha. All I seem to want is sleep. Then do it, I told her. I'm take care of things. Then she went on. What about this? What about that? Said she knew Hallie was no trouble, but she wanted to know if school teacher was handling the Pauls all right. And Sixo. Yes, ma'am, I said. Look like it. Do they do what he tells them? They don't need telling. Good. That's a mercy. I should be back downstairs in a day or two. I just need more rest. Doctor's due back. Tomorrow, is it? You said features, ma'am. What? Features? Like a feature of summer is heat. Characteristic is a feature. A thing that's natural to a thing. Can you have more than one? You can have quite a few. You know, say a baby sucks its thumb. That's one, but it has others too. Keep Billy away from Red Cora. Mr. Garner never let her cab every other year. Zetha, you hear me? Come away from that window and listen. Yes, ma'am. Ask my brother-in-law to come up after supper. Yes, ma'am. If you wash your hair, you could get rid of that lice. Ain't no lice in my head, ma'am. Whatever it is, a good scrubbing is what it needs, not scratching. Don't tell me we're out of soap. No, ma'am. All right now, I'm through. Talking makes me tired. Yes, ma'am. And thank you, Zetha. Yes, ma'am. You was too little to remember the quarters. Your brothers slept under the window. Me, you, and your daddy slept by the wall. The night after I heard why school teacher measured me, I had trouble sleeping. When Hallie came in, I asked him what he thought about school teacher. He said there wasn't nothing to think about. Said, he's white, ain't he? I said, but I mean, is he like Mr. Garner? What you want to know, Zetha? Him and her, I said. They ain't like the whites I seen before. The ones in the big place I was before I came here. How these different? He asked me. Well, I said, they talk soft, for one thing. It don't matter, Zetha. What they say is the same, loud or soft. Mr. Garner let you buy out your mother, I said. Yep, he did. Well, if he hadn't, she would have dropped in his cooking stove. Still, he did it. Let you work it off. Wake up, Hallie. I said, uh-huh. He could have said no. He didn't tell you no. No, he didn't tell me no. She worked here for 10 years. If she worked another 10, You think she would have made it out? I pay him for her last years, and in return he got you, me, and three more coming up. I got one more year of debt work, one more. School teacher in there told me to quit it. Said the reason for doing it don't hold. I should do the extra, but here at Sweet Home. Is he gonna pay you for the extra? Nope. Then how are you gonna pay it off? How much is it? $123.70. Does he want it back? He wants something. What? I don't know. Something. But he don't want me off Sweet Home no more. Say it don't pay to have my labor somewhere else while the boys is small. What about the money you owe? He must have another way of getting it. What way? I don't know, Setha. Then the only question is how. How is he gonna get it? No. That's one question. There's one more. What's that? He leaned up and turned over, touching my cheek with his knuckles. The question now is, who's gonna buy you out? Or me? Or her? He pointed over to where you was laying. What? If all my labor is Sweet Home, including the extra, what I got left to sell? He turned over then and went back to sleep. And I thought I wouldn't, but I did too for a while. Something he said, maybe, or something he didn't say woke me. I sat up like somebody hit me, and you woke up too and commenced to cry. I rocked you some, but there wasn't much room, so I stepped outside the door to walk you. Up and down I went, up and down. Everything dark but lamplight in the top window of the house. She must have been up still. I couldn't get out of my head the thing that woke me up. While the boys is small. That's what he said, and it snapped me awake. They tagged after me the whole day, weeding, milking, getting firewood. For now. That's when we should have begun to plan, but we didn't. I don't know what we thought, but getting away was a money thing to us, buyout. Running was nowhere on our minds. All of us, some, where to, how to go. It was Sixo who brought it up finally, after Paul left. Miss Garner sold him, trying to keep things up. Already she lived 2 years off his price. But it ran out, I guess. So she wrote school teacher to come take over. 4 Sweet Home men, and she still believed she needed her brother-in-law and 2 boys, 'cause people said she shouldn't be alone out there with nothing but Negroes. So he came with a big hat and spectacles and a coach box full of paper, talking soft and watching hard. He beat Paul A. Not hard and not long, but it was the first time anyone had because Mr. Garner disallowed it. Next time I saw him, he had company in the prettiest trees you ever saw. Sixo started watching the sky. He was the only one who crept at night, and Hallie said that's how he learned about the train. That way, Hallie was pointing over the stable where he took my ma'am. Sixo say freedom is that way. A whole train is going, and if we can get there, don't need to be no buyout. Train? What's that? I asked him. They stopped talking in front of me then, even Hallie, but they whispered among themselves, and Sixo watched the sky. Not the high part, the low part, where it touched the trees. You could tell his mind was gone from Sweet Home. The plan was a good one, but when it came time, I was big with Denver. So we changed it a little. A little. Just enough to butter Hallie's face, so Paul D tells me, and make Sixo laugh at last. But I got you out, baby, and the boys too,
when the signal for the train come, you all was the only ones ready. I couldn't find Hallie or nobody. I didn't know Sixo was burned up and Paul D dressed in a collar you wouldn't believe, not till later. So I sent you all to the wagon with a woman who waited in the corn. Ha ha. No notebook for my babies and no measuring string neither. What I had to get through later, I got through because of you. Passed right by those boys, hanging in the trees. One had Paulie's shirt on, but not his feet or his head. I walked right on by, because only me had your milk. And God do what he would, I was going to get it to you. You remember that, don't you? That I did? That when I got here, I had milk enough for all. One more curve in the road, and Setha could see her chimney. It wasn't lonely-looking anymore. The ribbon of smoke was from a fire that warmed a body, returned to her, just like it never went away, never needed a headstone. And the heart that beat inside it had not for a single moment stopped in her hands. She opened the door, walked in, and locked it tight behind her. The day stamp paid saw the two backs through the window and then hurried down the steps. He believed the undecipherable language clamoring around the house was the mumbling of the black and angry dead. Very few had died in bed like Baby Suggs, and none that he knew of, including Baby, had lived a livable life. Even the educated colored, the long school people, the doctors, the teachers, the paper writers, and businessmen had a hard row to hoe. In addition to having to use their heads to get ahead, they had the weight of the whole race sitting there. You needed two heads for that. White people believed that whatever the manners, under every dark skin was a jungle, swift, unnavigable waters, swinging, screaming baboons, sleeping snakes, red gums ready for their sweet white blood. In a way, he thought, they were right. The more colored people spent their strength trying to convince them how gentle they were, how clever and loving, how human, the more they used themselves up to persuade whites of something Negroes believed could not be questioned, the deeper and more tangled the jungle grew inside. But it wasn't the jungle blacks brought with them to this place from the other livable place. It was the jungle white folks planted in them. And it grew. It spread. In, through, and after life, it spread until it invaded the whites who had made it. Touched them, everyone, changed and altered them, made them bloody, silly, worse than even they wanted to be, so scared were they of the jungle they had made. The screaming baboon lived under their own white skin. The red gums were their own. Meantime, the secret spread of this new kind of white folks' jungle was hidden. Silent, except once in a while, when you could hear its mumbling in places like 124. Stamp Paid abandoned his efforts to see about Setha after the pain of knocking and not gaining entrance, and when he did, 124 was left to its own devices. When Setha locked the door, the women inside were free at last to be what they liked. See whatever they saw, and say whatever was on their minds. Almost, mixed in with the voices surrounding the house, recognizable but undecipherable to Stamp Paid, were the thoughts of the women of 124. Unspeakable thoughts, unspoken. Beloved, she my daughter. She mine. See, she come back to me of her own free will, and I don't have to explain a thing. I didn't have time to explain before because it had to be done quick, quick. She had to be safe, and I put her where she would be. But my love was tough, and she back now. I knew she would be. Paul D. ran her off, so she had no choice but to come back to me in the flesh. I bet you baby Suggs on the other side helped. I won't never let her go. I'll explain to her, even though I don't have to, why I did it. How if I hadn't killed her, she would have died. And that is something I could not bear to happen to her. When I